That's how you say it. I say sabotage.
You're listening to Around Comics, episode 262, brought to you by InStockTrades.com. From Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week a revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics, once again, is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you are in the area, please drop by. Hey there, folks. Christopher Niesman here.
We all sound Chris. We're irritated by this episode.
Yes, episode 261, major technical difficulties, and we're ready to go now. I'm recharged. Here, I'm going to have a shot of whiskey.
The good parts.
You go ahead and imbibe.
We saved the good parts.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's just some attempts at voicemail didn't work out, so...
I blame the voicemails.
We rushed the ending.
I blame the fact that we solicit feedback.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like,
it never works out.
This show is doomed to never play another voicemail ever again.
We got that phone number. No one's ever going to get on the air because it's just the bad luck.
Can't fight fate, my friend. Let me get everybody introduced here. Tom Caters, as always.
Hi, yes.
Tom. Hi.
Shake off the negativity. Yeah. Let's get loose.
Okay.
Let's have fun today.
Next is the voice of Word Bloom, Mr. John Suntress.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, as always.
Thanks for making it back from last week.
My pleasure, as always. Glad to be back at Dark Towers here. Exactly.
Next is a guest formerly known as Tiny Hank. And,
he ain't tiny no more.
He's not tiny anymore.
I've grown.
Hank?
I've grown. Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, good to be back.
Hank is back. You know what? You know, I was thinking about this coming in today because you told me you were gonna drop by and sit in with us. We've been doing this for a day or two now. We're about 5 years into the show, and we've known you for about 3 or 4 years now.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, you were like a sophomore in high school whenever we met you, and now
today you're 65 years old.
Yes. You're a freshman at Columbia College now.
Yes,
you're first-year film student, and we always used to make jokes about, you know, Tiny Hank, and you're not Tiny Hank anymore. You're making me feel old, you son of a bitch.
There will always be a part of me that is Tiny Hank.
That is Tiny Hank, yeah.
Hey, so, man, that's between you and your maker. Always, I'm sorry to hear about that.
There will always be a part of me that looks down on Hank.
But no, it's good to see you, man.
Thank you.
Just kidding, Hank.
Mike Norton.
Get your hand off my leg.
Mike Norton. And Sal and I had the opportunity to be part of your first student film. Is it your first student
film?
Yeah,
the first one.
Yeah. What'd you shoot, man?
What
was it about?
It's about gambling. And
cool.
My buddies here played some gamblers at a casino table.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Sal was very kind enough to loan us his
fist.
His fist. There is an action part. And he brought a huge table, about 1,000 chips. He was very, very helpful.
Oh, were you like able a set designer. That's were you good. Able to convince Chris not to look directly into the camera the whole time?
Not the whole time.
Sal would make an excellent pit boss.
You were great. We got a close-up on you. You look beautiful.
Was Sal the pit boss? Because he would make a great pit boss. I could
Sal
see
is the one that throws the punch.
There you go. Exactly. Yes. No, you want Sal to throw the punch. That's good. I like that. And he knows how to throw a punch.
Yeah,
I've seen
exactly.
Him.
Yeah, Sal's the guy who wins on the all-in and has to put a...
Spoilers.
Spoilers for this.
Yeah, hey, he has to put
film.
A guy down.
Yeah. Wow. But we're shooting it, and Sal has to punch his guy, and he does it.
Tell me he punches Norton, please.
No. Oh, that'd be perfect. But he punches a friend of mine, and I call cut. And everyone just looks at the guy that Sal almost punched, and Sal grazed him, and he's like, "If I got any closer, I would have clocked him. Sal looked so concerned.
Are you okay? Very funny. It was awesome. But, you know, definitely want to hear a little bit about being a first-year film student a little bit later. But first of all, I need to let everyone know that this episode, as always, is brought to you by InStockTrades.com. We're waiting for the trade. It's never been easier. InStockTrades.com is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, omnibus editions, absolute editions, essentials, showcases, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 do, in fact, ship for free. That's all at InStockTrades.com. And you just heard our book club selection broadcast on Hellblazer, Dangerous Habits. And then Tom revealed his pick, which is the first pocketbook of Strangers in Paradise. Yeah. So you can pick that
up. SIP for those in the know.
SIP is a little sip.
Sip.
So you can get some get on sip. That you can, sip. You can get Sip Volume 1 at InStockTrades.com right now. All right, guys.
Purple drink.
Let's talk some comic books. Tom, I told you today, I've had my cranky pants on, that you were going to have to carry the show, so I think
you got... I'm not used to that.
Y'all, thank you. I appreciate it. But you got all excited and got a big old pile of comic books.
I got as excited as I usually get.
Yes.
First thing I want to talk about was The Unwritten. Have you guys been reading this?
It's excellent.
From Vertigo, written by Mike Carey with art by Peter Gross. I think I talked about the first issue of this.
Yeah, it was a great first issue.
Yeah, and it has continued to be extremely strong. It's about a, as a quick recap, it's a guy whose dad wrote kind of Harry Potter, but named it after, let's imagine the guy's name is Harry Potter. So he's been kind of living off the fact that he's the quote-unquote real-life Harry Potter.
It's like Tommy Taylor. Showing my age, I even though you're right, I was thinking too, like Christopher Robin from like the Winnie the Pooh books.
Yeah, because, I could see that.
Because A.A. Milne's son was Christopher Robin, and he resented dad doing
that. We have this guy whose dad created this fictional universe he's named after. He's been pigeonholed his whole life. Now he's in a situation where the things from the book are starting to become real. And he doesn't quite know who he is. He's been kind of exposed as sort of a fraud, but not really. Like
in that first issue, he's at a convention and the guy stands up and says, "You're a fake."
It's not like something he did. He didn't really know where, you know, who his real parents were. This is a standalone issue, which deals with the fact that one of the previous issues, Tommy Taylor was at a gathering of different writers, of genre writers, and a bunch of the genre writers got murdered, and he was framed for the murder. So he's in this like French prison, and it deals with the warden of that prison and his family, and it deals with the fact that the warden's kids love these Tommy Taylor books to the like degree that it affects their lives. And I thought it was a really cool story, sort of, because we live in this age where people really, I guess people have always really gotten into shit, but like these kids, like it affects the daughter so much that she gets suspended from school because she pokes a kid in the eye, like almost takes his eye out, like casting a spell to defend herself. And she has a hard time determining reality from the Tommy Taylor books. And the dad is sheltering her, saying, "The kids should be able to imagine whatever they want. We got to protect that." And now it's starting to tie into the story where she's going to go save Tommy Taylor and cast the doubt about whether and, you know, what part of this is real and what part isn't. But it really resonated with me in the idea of how people can so put themselves into the stuff they read, whether it's Harry Potter or Batman or Spider-Man or a Vertigo book that they're reading, that when people love fiction, sometimes they put themselves so much into it that it is too far. It is too much. It is a little weird, a little creepy, but that's part of the excitement of reading fiction, is putting yourself into that. And it was a really cool standalone story that fits into the overall story, but furthers the plot as well. And it's been a really pleasant surprise. I'm a little bit under the radar as far as the Vertigo books go, but I think it's one of the strongest books that's been coming out. And it's been a tremendous amount of fun.
What issue is that?
This is number 8.
Have they not released
yeah, I was gonna say, there hasn't been a trade yet, has there?
No, there has not been a trade.
I wonder if they're going to do what they've been doing with Xanadu, when Man of Xanadu first started. It was, like, it was 10 issues.
10 issues.
And then they released the trade.
Yeah, there hasn't been a clean break yet in the storytelling. It's all been sort of the same story. And Tommy Taylor is running into, like, Frankenstein, you know, like, fictional characters that have come to life that are, like, trying to tell him things, and people will, it's all about paparazzi and fiction and stuff like that. So it's been really pleasant surprise.
It's a traditional in a good sense Vertigo kind of story, I think. Something that would fit in with the Tim Hunter stuff and the previous Mike Carey things like Lucifer and things like that. I like the Unwritten a lot. And again, it's funny that you say Harry Potter, and I'm sure that is what's on the mind of people. But yeah, I mean, just knowing that story about A.A. Milne and Christopher Robin, the real Christopher Robin, and how much he really hated the fact that his father kind of made him this, because so many people would just come to him weeping and saying, "Oh God,
Winnie the Pooh like?"
Well, and just and literally just
he didn't
said,
oh. do it. It's not like he didn't make it.
And it was really just, you know, a character that was just based on his name, and really he had no connection to it, and grew to really detest the character. And his
I hate Winnie the Pooh. I hate that fucking bear. I hate Eeyore.
I would kick Piglet down the street.
So it's a great place to start and tell a unique story in the way that Mike Carey normally does. No, it's I like the Unwritten a lot.
Well, I've been remiss in reading it. I've been waiting for the trade on that. I'm one of those guys.
You're ruining the industry.
I know it's me. Another book that I trade weight on, I decided to pick up this single issue because I was not willing to wait for it. And I'll tell you what, it shot to the top of my list of best single issues.
Was it a beacon of light?
It was a beacon of light for the comic industry. My favorite issue of the year to this point has been Jonah Hex number 50.
Really?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was just...
No. Yeah, I want to go read that.
Oh, what?
I need to read that.
Oh, it's so good.
Hank, you're on. Oh, goddamn, Hank, you're.
I'm texting. I'm sorry.
No, I've been. I have been picking up the series monthly. It's excellent. It's excellent.
Jimmy Palmiotti, Justin Gray, and this one is drawn by Darwin Cook. And Darwin Cook is just. He's always fantastic.
So Jonah Hex at the end, like, is happy, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And the town loves him.
Yes.
And everyone loves him.
And he gets the girl.
And his face is healed.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Don't want to spoil it.
He looks just like Clint Eastwood.
Oh, wow.
Today,
What are they going to do in 51?
This is a perfect Jonah Hex story. There is... there's revenge and violence and justice and just terrible, terrible, horrible things happen to people. It's a fantastic Western, and it's everything that a standalone Jonah Hex story should be. What I love is how Darwin Cook draws Tallulah Black, who is a great character, and she and Jonah Hex are—they're just cut from the same cloth, and they're so perfect for each other in a way that they will never be with each other. Mm-hmm. And this is so clear in this book, but
it seems like they save a lot of the really exceptional scripts for Darwin, because just last year when Hex went to Canada, that was like a really cool
one in the snow.
Uh-huh.
Here, yeah.
So it's very, you know, it, no, and I'd be right. I mean, Darwin is perfect, a perfect guy to draw Jonah Hex.
It's Jonah Hex 50, and there are there's so many little threads that run through the story, but one of the major threads that does go through it is that there are 50 bounties that Jonah Hex is approached to hunt down, these 50 men with prices on their head, and that kind of runs through the story and what they do to kind of get together because they know that hell is coming on a horse, and what they do to battle Jonah Hex, and you know, you just know going in that you know Jonah he's a force of nature that is not going to be stopped, and I'm not going to give it away, but there is a splash page at the end of it that is the most awesome grizzled image of Jonah Hex that you could ever ask for, and that it's Darwin Cook doing it is just like, you stop there and you're just like, okay, that is fucking awesome. It was a great Jonah Hex issue, and Jonah Hex is a great series. And if you ever thought about jumping into it, or if you're a Western, God, if you're a Western fan, you need to be reading this book. It was awesome.
With the exception of the last arc.
If you're a Western fan, you're not reading it, you're just a stupid asshole.
Yeah, really. Pretty much. Well, I was going to say, pretty much. Really, with the exception of that last six issues story arc they wrapped up with 49, Jimmy and Justin have been very specific about doing the book the way that it was done for a long time in Weird Western Tales, too, in terms of one-and-done stories. And literally have been getting the best artists they possibly can from
Jordy Bernay has been
there. Ronaldo, and it's I don't know if it's Gudis or Gudis or whatever. But yeah, man, unbelievable. I mean, that's the thing. Wonderful South American artists, wonderful European artists. David Michael Beck has been in there. Luke Ross has been in there.
Who doesn't love American Westerns?
Well, you know, a couple weeks ago on your other podcast, 11 O'Clock Comics, I heard Vince kind of saying that he wants DC to kind of publicize it more. Let's face it. Comic book westerns, it's not 1960 anymore.
Yeah.
It's not 19. Actually, I should say it's not 1955 anymore. They don't. But the good news is for there is a movie coming out. And the powers that be at DC understand the value of this character. I mean, he's a distinct Western hero that is about to be exploited in it looks like a good way. They got, you know, Josh Brolin playing him. I forget who wrote it. Matt Singer from IFC, one of the movie critics, was telling me that the guys that wrote the Crank movies with Neville Jason Statham. Thank you, Hank. Attaboy. That's why we got the film guy here. Exactly. No, they wrote the script, and all indications are that it is, you know, going to be a good movie. And much like I think when Hellboy came out, for everyone that ignored it and never really thought about the character, and for people that will be exposed to Jonah Hex for the first time in the film, they will be able to go and find several volumes of new Jonah Hex material with beautiful art and wonderful stories.
Yeah.
They get it. They plot Jonah Hex in a lot of ways like a weekly Western TV series. Yep. And in fact, Jimmy has said it time and time again that as great as the film is going to be, it would be a better television show. And I think he's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, so
it's a great comic that I think years from now people are going to look back and go, wow, Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray's Jonah Hex was a great series.
But by the same token, pick up the Showcase, because really John Albano Tony DeZuniga and Tony's drawn a couple issues here and there of the current Hex runners too.
That's the thing about those Showcases is that not all of them hold up incredibly well. I mean, there's.
They're saying world's finest. I'm
saying that there are a few that are of a period, and they may not be the
triplets.
They may not hold up so good. Haunted Tank. But there are two Showcases that I've read that
I know the other one you're going to say.
Is Jonah Hex and Batlash.
Yep. And then Batlash is only $10, and it's thin because there weren't that many Batlash stories.
Such a great, and I really liked that format because it was kind of like a half a Showcase.
Yeah.
It was it was much smaller than the phone book style.
Yeah, there's only like 20, if there's 20 stories in there, that's it.
Oh, great stories.
But they're excellent stories. I mean, it's beautiful Nick Carty art and... Oh.
If you're a Western fan, pick up that Batlash Showcase. It's fantastic. Well,
all those non-superhero genres that DC was doing in the 60s and 70s, really, and even in the 50s. I mean, Robert Kanigher, and you know from his Flash stuff, but really, you know, give him a war story or a Western. I mean, the guy really knew how to write. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those, like, 11-page stories are actually really good. And the art is beautiful.
You look at the Silver Age comics, mm-hmm. The superhero stuff feels dated, but you look at stuff like House of Mystery or Haunted Tank or Jonah Hex or Batlash, and those really feel like timeless tales.
Yeah.
Well, they hold up so well.
Well, and I think, and I know for, in the case of the war books, you did have adults still reading it, and, mm-hmm. and you had creators like Russ Heath and Joe Kubert who were very, and Kaniger, who were very serious about maintaining the quality. And remember that generation,
Russ Heath, is
that
so
post
awesome.
That post-war generation. There were a lot of adults that were still reading those books mm-hmm. and stuff. The superhero comics were written for a 10-year-old audience. It was, and then that's why they are kind of hokey and they don't hold up as well. So much time.
Now, Hank, as an aspiring filmmaker,
as a young man,
as an AFM,
an aspiring filmmaker,
do you like old westerns?
You like westerns, Hank? You like Gladiator movies?
I do. I do. I don't
you
get
like Gladiator movies.
It's a recent
interest
for me. Which are your guys? Which Hank? I can thank Sal for. But,
yeah. So what filmmakers are you watching right now, western wise?
I'm getting into the John Ford stuff.
There you go. That a boy.
The Eastwood stuff that he directed in like the 70s, like
cool.
The classics. I never watched westerns when I was a kid.
There weren't that many good ones.
None of my friends like my age.
That's Saturday and Sunday afternoon cable TV stuff.
Yeah, you know? I mean, but
when you're not watching Legends of the Seeker, like me and your wife, Tom.
Yeah, I know. That's me. Legends of the Seeker's on. Gotta get the popcorn ready.
I'll get the popcorn.
Once Upon a Time in the West is one.
That, yeah, oh, yeah, Leone, I need, yeah. The Sergio Leone stuff. I've seen the Dollar Trilogy, but I need a.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So good.
Yeah,
so
John, you can start with John Ford, and there you go. Mm-hmm. Hey, have you seen The Searchers yet?
Yes,
incredible.
Yeah, great.
Incredible.
A lot better than that. I was expecting something so much different out of the westerns, and then I saw it, and it just blew me away.
Yeah. Well,
and I thought they were just going to be boring as hell.
And for audiophiles, I love the television show Gunsmoke, but my God, the radio show Gunsmoke was incredible and really? So well acted.
Some good Foley.
Truly.
Some good Foley.
Tom, I swear to God, you like they're walking on a wooden sidewalk of a western town. Yeah. You hear the keys as the jail door is opening. I mean,
cup,
incredible Foley. I mean, and also by that time in the 50s, sound recording had really, you know, tape recording had really achieved a level of sophistication that you didn't have in the 1930s when, you know, you had the guy at the cap pistol right next to the microphone. You know. But it's, no, honestly, Gunsmoke, and in fact, Jeff Darrow and I have talked about it. Jeff's a big Western fan. Yeah. And
we got to get Jeff Darrow here to record with
yeah,
us.
No, okay. Well, yeah, okay. Well, I saw you tweeting a certain comic book creator who I won't name.
Well, you know,
Jill
Thompson. I think Jill's going to come sit in with us soon.
But yeah, I think Jeff would come in. Yeah, I mean, there you go. And I'm sure I would love to see, and it's certainly Shaolin Cowboy.
Mm-hmm. We should get Jill and Jeff on the same show.
Oh, you don't want to? Oh, no. You want to spend time with both of them, man. But no, Jeff would definitely, like, go nuts. And I'm sure Jeff would love to draw a Jonah Hex or, you know, even the Marvel, you know, Two-Gun Kids and mm-hmm. various creative characters. Interesting that Marvel hasn't really been able to, you know, they've tried. Yeah. I mean, guys like Chuck Dixon have written very good westerns within the last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
And for whatever reasons, Marvel doesn't seem to be interested in maintaining a...
Westerns are tough.
Yeah,
they're cool. It's a tough sell.
What was the Vertigo book? Was that Loveless? Is that so awesome?
And you know, I like Loveless, mm-hmm. and it's a little grittier than what Jimmy and mm-hmm. Justin do in Jonah Hex, and it's a little more real. And I'm trying to even like I'd almost say Jonah Hex is like kind of John Ford to their Sergio Leone. I would say
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Loveless was dealing with post-Civil War.
Yes.
The post-Civil War South. So you're dealing with a lot of, you know, white-black relations, and it was a nasty Western.
And the politics of the time, too, Reconstruction and things like that. No, I love the way Azzarello ended that book and just really how this man, you know, came out of prison to a world that had changed and left him behind and really was kind of not only, you know, lost, but really mm-hmm. like hopeless. I mean, loveless and hopeless at the end of his story. And really, you know, things didn't look good. It was not a happy ending.
You know, we look at this year as we're kind of winding down 2009. It's been a good year for genre books. And I was thinking on the drive up here, about some of the really, really good World War II comics that have come out this year. Now, Tom, you're a fan of Garth Ennis's Battlefields.
Yes, I am.
Which was fantastic.
Yes, I am.
I just finished reading Storming Paradise, which is Chuck Dixon.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The aforementioned.
And Butch Geis.
Chuck Dixon and Butch Geis. Really good year for World War II comics.
Yes, it was. There's some really good stuff that came out.
And Billy Tucci's Sergeant Rock was fantastic.
Yes, of course.
I love Storming Paradise because it's about what would have happened if the atomic bomb hadn't worked and we had to proceed with the land invasion of Japan. And my dad was in basic training for Operation Olympia.
He would have been there.
And would have been there. And I always remind my sister of that and say, you know, there's a good chance we wouldn't have been alive because much like D-Day, you know, he was infantry. He would have been infantry.
Well, they estimated that we would have lost about 100,000 troops if a conventional
land invasion
of Japan. And this book, Storming Paradise, by Chuck Dixon and Butch Geis from Wildstorm, kind of details. It's kind of a fictional history of what would have happened. Really, really compelling. And I read this. I had put it off. I read this after the World War II HD. Had you watched that?
Yes, on the History Channel. It's fantastic.
Oh my God, it was so good.
Yeah. And also, by the way, as we mentioned, Chuck Dixon and talking about Westerns, he's taken over Dynamite's, what started as Man with No Name, but then they got smart and said, let's name it after the movie because people might not know that it's the same character. But yeah, it's now called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I would say that what Brubaker has been doing for Crime in Criminal, Chuck continues to do for Westerns in The Good, and the Bad, and the Ugly. And it's one of Dynamite's best books. And again, if you're looking for more Westerns, Chuck has got you
covered. I was going to say the way that they wrote Storming Paradise was almost like a disaster movie.
Yeah.
You know, where it was bunch of different characters all over the place. What happens to everyone?
Alternating vignettes of what's going on. Yeah, my only criticism of Storming Paradise is that it was 6 issues.
Yeah,
I think it would have been better if it was a 10 or 12 issue series because there were things that happened to those characters that they stuck at me and it hurt. But if there had been a little bit more time with the character development, it would have really twisted the knife. You know what I mean?
I think we'd still be waiting for issues. And I love Jackson Geis, but
And I loved it. You know, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed it, but I felt like it needed a little bit more space to breathe. You remember Winds of War?
Sure, loved it. Herman Wook, absolutely.
Winds of War was for our younger listeners like Hank. Have you ever seen
a novel before?
It was the Winds of War.
No.
A big TV event. There was a big long miniseries, kind of in the
Bob Mitchum,
kind of like in the ilk of Roots.
It was a miniseries. Yeah.
It was a great novel. Herman Wolf, The Winds of War. But it was a very, very long, in-depth miniseries. I remember it. It was in high school, I think it was coming out, and it was noted for being the first time on network TV that you saw frontal nudity.
Yeah, hot, man.
And a very graphic depiction of the Holocaust as well.
That was the frontal nudity. Is that they were not hot. Hurting naked Jews into gas chambers. So yeah. I mean, it was. But this was on network TV. But
glad you told me that now because I got it for some jollies.
But you know, Winds of War was fantastic, and Storming Paradise kind of reminded me of that in the scope of that. You know, that miniseries. The novel was written that it was these vignettes of different characters and different scenes through this world war. And I thought Storming Paradise needed a little bit more air in it. I wanted to see, you know, like the tail.
Much like Hitler, you wanted it to have some elbow room, some breathing room.
Yes. But no, it was fantastic. Right. It's just one of those, I wanted maybe another 3 or 4 issues. I wanted more, and I think that's
more?
I think that's a credit to how good it was.
You need to find your Chamberlain.
Richard?
To appease you.
Or by Richard Chamberlain.
You're Richard Chamberlain? Exactly. You're Neville Chamberlain.
I was going to say Richard Chamberlain. We're on to
speaking of miniseries,
an entirely different, Thornbirds?
Thornbird, Shogun, Mike. He was the king of miniseries.
The king of the TV miniseries.
Exactly.
Hank's just like, oh my gosh.
Is yeah, this you guys are lost. Sorry. Yeah, sorry, kid. It's all right.
All right, so that's enough of World War II and lost miniseries.
Am I, stealing from, your pile?
Go ahead. Go for it.
Blackest Night Flash, and I'm glad, Tom, because we rarely get a chance to really talk about stuff like this.
Yes.
I've been enjoying Rebirth, Flash Rebirth.
Yeah.
And I'm conflicted because on the one hand I'm very excited by what this story is where it's starting, but by the same token I'm a little disappointed because
finish it.
Yeah, it's a little spoilerific if you're waiting for the end of Flash Rebirth, you're kind of getting a lot of the facts in here.
Well, sort of. I mean, the dead body of Thawne is really, you know that Thawne's life is always going to end since he's a time traveler at the point when Barry snaps his neck, you know, in 85 or
85.
R85, yeah. 83 probably was that trial took like 2
Okay, that's
fucking years.
Oh, yeah, you're right about that. I forgot about that. Okay,
the trial
go ahead.
Took 2 years. So, kind of. I mean, I think Rebirth is separate from the fact that it's like they've kind of moved on and just had the Flash and a bunch of stuff, which he's been good.
I'm okay with that.
Well, and also this really, and that's why I'm excited about it. And let's accentuate the positive. And I would say that it's great to see Barry back, and where the story seems to be going as well. The Rogues are, of course, involved in Scott.
I think the misconception is that this is a follow-up to Flash Rebirth. I see this as kind of a extension of Final Crisis Rogues Revenge.
Well, I was going to say, exactly. It definitely is. No, I think there are threads of that. And, of course, obviously, it being a Blackest Night tie-in, there's that as well. But that's where I am excited, because just as it's great to see Barry back, it's great to have the Rogues back. And the threat of Barry out there for them to deal with as well.
And Black Lantern Solovar. Oh,
absolutely, man.
So good.
So sad.
Very sad. Well, and again, that's one of those perfect relationships to hurt Barry with.
Tom, John, catch me up. Solovar, how did he die?
It was a couple years ago where he got assassinated by Grodd. It was like...
makes sense. I kind of figured Grodd did it. I didn't know.
I think it had something to do with Jail Ape. It was right before. It was
like,
Tom
versus JLA.
Grodd had Solovar assassinated, I believe, at some point, and then Solovar's son is in
That's
charge
right.
of...
That's right. He's in charge of Gorilla City. Yes, yeah. Solovar's son.
Is in charge of Gorilla City.
Lamont.
So.
The Lamont Sanford of Gorilla City.
Yeah. Lamont
you
Solovar.
Big dummy.
Lamontar is the... is in charge of Gorilla City. He picked up the mantle.
Yes.
For Solovar. But it was interesting to sort of see.
Did you notice my gray temples kind of resemble Solovar's? I've let my hair gray out.
John, you've always, had. Whenever I think of you, I always think of the much esteemed leader of Gorilla City. I always think of the way when you come lumbering in, just like
John. At some point, we all become silverbacks.
I know, exactly. You're gonna become Solovar. But
bow your head, like Michael Clark Duncan in Pound of the Year.
Yeah, it was fun to read the part. You know, just sort of explaining how Barry was good friends with Solovar, and then see
it broke his heart.
And it was like, see Solovar come back,
and also to see Barry fighting the. If not urge, the whatever force is, you know, making these guys turn into Black Lanterns.
Yeah. I also thought it was a unique... Most of the time when you've seen the Black Lanterns, they just sort of come back and, like, taunt them.
Yeah.
But the Solovar one had a very different approach to it, where he was...
Help me.
Yeah, he was, like, begging Barry to help him, even though there's nothing that Barry can do to... bring, you know, but Barry's got doubt in his mind because is this how Reverse Flash comes back? You know, why is Reverse, you know, like, is this how things happen? Is there a way to save Solovar? Is there something I can do to help him?
And it's heart-wrenching.
And the
tease
we're getting in issue one, we don't really get much of it, but certainly we know that some dead rogues are coming, and they're right there on the in the big splash page.
It's such a great comic book convention to list the live rogues on one page and the dead rogues on the other.
I mean, you're going to have the Golden Glider.
That's which is Lensnart's sister.
That's right, Captain Cold's sister.
You got the original Mirror Master. You got Rainbow Raider.
Sam Scudder, which I forgot his name was Scudder.
Scudder.
Roscoe Dillon, the top. I love the top.
The original Trickster.
Yes, yeah, James Hubert. Jesse, who became a good guy, and of course, well featured in 50, Countdown,
yeah.
And really the one of the few storylines of Countdown that I actually liked,
yeah.
Was them kind of, you know, shackled together. Who was he? Who was he?
Piper.
Oh, that's right, Piper. That's right. And of course, Digger Hawkins, the original Captain Boomerang.
Yep.
I certainly hope he faces the
current,
at least Deadshot, if not the entire Secret Six.
Ooh.
Well, yeah, it was sort of interesting because this issue was. I'm going to be kind of interested to see how they wrap up all the threads in two other issues because they introduce a lot of stuff in the first issue of the Rogues having to deal with all the dead Rogues. You know,
true. The one thing, and based on my conversation, and it'll have already been out, I think, by the time this airs, but when Ruck and I were talking about Blackest Night, Wonder Woman, and in that first issue...
Very interesting parallel between these two.
Yeah, because there's, like, unfinished business, much like in this issue with Wonder Woman and Max Lord, and I even talked to Greg about that, because not knowing where the next two issues of Blackest Night, Wonder Woman were going to go... I'm like, oh, is this your – I'm like, you know, you wrote the story of Wonder Woman killing Max. Here's a really good opportunity to kind of really play in that milieu and find out, you know, some
– Revisit that.
Right. Yeah. And resolve it at least for Diana or whatever. And I'm like, oh, this is a good opportunity. And he said, yeah, that kind of isn't going to happen because he said what you see in issue one is pretty much it. And it's, again, it's that tug of war between serving the bigger story –
Yeah.
But also telling its own story as well. So it's going to be interesting to see. And obviously the fact that Jeff is writing this might make it easier. But, you know, Greg was able to address some things in that Blackest Night Wonder Woman. He seemed to think that there's still more to say. But he even doesn't know what I think DC's policy is in terms of where that murder is in Diana's...
I think there will always be something to say with that particular part of Wonder Woman and Max Lord's relationship and what she had to do. But Blackest Night Flash and Blackest Night Wonder Woman, they lead into the events that happen in Blackest Night number 5.
Right.
And I think that's where these series pick up. So I'm okay with them kind of leaving that hanging. I mean, that's going to be something that is going to be a part of Wonder Woman's legacy for a long time.
If they choose to address it, I'm starting to get the feeling that maybe it's kind of like Mary Jane and Peter Parker's baby that never really got resolved in the Clone War.
You know,
the Clone
Saga. But I think Greg is pretty open about saying, you know what, she is a warrior. And she did the right thing for her. And I think that will be a theme that will be revisited over and over again. And I'm okay with that.
But I kind of, and not to divert from Blackest Night Flash, but to stay on Wonder Woman for a second, I'd like to see her have that conversation with Bruce and Clark and say, look, this is why I did it.
Yeah.
Get over it.
I think they understand that.
Well, I don't know.
Bruce does more than Clark does.
Well, then she needs to have that conversation with Clark maybe because – and again, I have a feeling that maybe the powers that be are saying, yeah, no, let's move on.
Yeah.
Because each month that it gets further away
– I think it's fascinating.
I completely agree.
For her to say, you know what? You are everything that is good about us. But you know what? Sometimes it's the Jack Nicholson. It's Jack Nicholson.
Right, you meet me on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. There are walls that need to be protected, and you don't like to look at it, but I have to be there.
Well, the other thing too is, and Greg has been very eloquent saying this in conventions. She did it because she loves Clark, and not in the sense that you know she is in love with Clark, but that she loves and cares about Clark. And it was like it was a no-win situation. She needed to be on that wall,
and almost.
And I almost, again, wish that Lois could be in that conversation as well because that's another thing that Greg, I think, postulated that she would tell Clark.
And I thought
she loves you, idiot.
I thought it was fantastic whenever Max Lord, as the Black Lanterns do, look at people in the emotional spectrum. And when you would expect Wonder Woman or Diana to be filled with hate – she's filled with love. She does things because she is filled with love for what is good.
Right. And she's fighting. Yeah, she's fighting the right battle for the right reasons and stuff.
Yeah, for love and not for hate. And I thought that you know sometimes Greg can be very heavy handed with, and people know that I think that Greg is a fantastic comic book writer.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes he can be a little heavy handed in hammering a point home. But I thought that. that was one moment where it's like, okay, we need to define this character that her motivation comes from a love of life and humanity, and this is everything that she stands for. And I thought that was awesome.
I don't know what sales, you know, Wonder Woman has had really in the last, you know, I'm going to even go back 5 years, but I will say that really from Rucka to Heinberg to Gale, they've had three very good creators who understand the character and have shown different sides of the character. And what you just described about what Greg brought to Wonder Woman, I think is very true. And still, it fits in with what Gale is currently doing with the character as well. So, yes. And I think that I hope that what Greg fears was just casual and hasn't, you know, isn't a real DC edict. I think the character is strong enough to face those kinds of realities. And for the audience, I think is strong enough to face those realities and just say, yeah, you know something, it's fine. And then when you make the Wonder Woman movie, feel free to ignore it. That's fine. But for the readers of the comic book and stuff like that, it would it'd be nice to see an adult version of Wonder Woman that has that stuff.
Yeah. She snapped his neck.
All right, Hank, I want to talk to you.
I haven't read comics in like 4 months.
But that's okay because, well, I mean, you've been
busy
going
with
school.
Ladies in college. Oh.
All right, so you are now an aspiring filmmaker. There are tons of comic book movies that have been made in the last 10, 15 years. As a film student, is there what kind of discussions have you guys had as film students? Is this in the conversation?
It is. When I have one film teacher that's been teaching at Columbia for like 35 years.
Okay.
And you know, he shows us the movies he shows us every week are, you know, like the 40s and 50s movies, you know, the 30s movies. And we were talking about modern someone brought up Lord of the Rings and he just like brushed it off and we're like, "Oh, well, what, you know, he never brings up movies that he values from like even the 90s." And so we were just talking about modern movies, you know, and the first he brought up Tarantino, Paul Thomas Anderson, Darren Aronofsky, and comic book movies. Like it was the fourth like big thing to happen.
Sure. And I think Aspen. Yeah
and everyone says the same things. There is, you know, if it's done well and taken seriously, I mean, or done the way that it's supposed to, like
Chris Nolan with the Dark
Knight. Everyone enjoys the Chris Nolan movies, but also everyone loves the Guillermo del Toro Hellboy movies.
Sure.
Just because they're just such fun movies.
Well, I heard Coppola complain that, you know, he said a lot of the big blockbusters that are being made now, he basically called them carnival rides, and he said that it's tough for him to kind of make the movies that he certainly was making 35 years ago, 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, to try and do a serious adult drama, you know, it goes against the movie-going audience, which is basically 16 to 34. Mm-hmm. And that's what Hollywood is catering to. I mean, look at the cast of Twilight, and that'll give you exactly what you want.
Ooh, hunky werewolves.
You know, without a shirt. Shirtless werewolves.
Jean shorts.
But no, but honestly, it's – and also the economics of movies are changing. And it's so weird that all the little art house studios and boutique studios seem to not be able to get the funding that they once had. Fox Searchlight. They went out of business.
Paramount Vantage.
Yeah, and Warner Brothers arm as well. Mm-hmm. The one that did Goodnight, Good Luck. I mean, they're all kind of shuttering those divisions of the indie films and the small dramas. They're closing them up.
Yeah, it's just the direction that film is going in. I mean,
and interesting, the television seems to be picking up the slack.
Yeah,
and that's where you're getting the complex drama.
The HBO Showtime shows.
Yes, and the season long stories. And that's what's more interesting is we're going from the 2 hour story to the 12 hour story that's being explored in television. But yeah, I mean, it's how do you reconcile the carnival ride that Coppola describes with real, you know, visual filmmaking like a Tarantino with
drama.
Yeah. How do you do it, Hank?
How are you going to do it, Hank?
How are you going to do it?
I'm going to
revolutionize. You're our future. Yeah, you're our future. No, but honestly, yeah. What do the professors say about?
Well, I mean, I have two film teachers, and one is a 28-year-old, and one is a 65-year-old, and the 65-year-old is very pessimistic. I mean,
he's very negative.
Yeah, I mean, he's very negative, and he sees no hope. And he brings up Twilight like every week, and you know? He brings up the Transformer. He's like, you guys want to make movies, you know, like
you want to make Transformers.
Yeah,
you want to make Transformers.
Yeah, he's like,
but you know, there's something to be said when it does do over $200 million.
He's like, those are the movies that are making money. Those are the movies that are going to mm-hmm. continue to get made.
I mean, it is a commercial business.
But, but for every Transformers, there's a Juno.
Yeah, Juno made like over $200 million.
Right, yeah, right.
But
it's a fantastic movie.
But for every Juno, there's a There Will Be Blood. That is a fantastic movie.
Wonderful.
It sank a studio. Yeah. I mean, it's just people
really did it. I didn't realize.
Yeah,
that.
People are. I mean,
what was that studio? Which studio was it?
It was Paramount Vantage.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, they're not showing up to see those movies. I mean,
yes. No, you're right. Well, and Paramount too, I know specifically had trouble where they had to like cut a fourth of their movie slate mm-hmm. because the investors mm-hmm. all took a hit from the financial collapse, mm-hmm. and it's like the money's not there. Mm-hmm. Something's got to give, and no, we're not going to cut Star Trek. Sorry,
we are going to
cut the little movies,
yeah, exactly,
or the ambitious movies.
Which is fascinating because it's the little movies that don't cost that much money.
Well, exactly. Well, and there was even an initiative, and I don't know if you've studied this yet, but I remember hearing this in film discussion that a lot of studios in the 90s really like made a pitch of let's make $10 million movies that are affordable.
That's when, I mean, Pulp Fiction cost $15 million.
Exactly.
Over $150 or something.
And there's a ton of these movies that still haven't made their budget back yet because nobody went to see them in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
So what I wonder about – sorry. Well, no, what I wonder about too is when – and I'm sure it's going to happen within the next 10 to 15 years when the first long, full-length thing – appears online and
online only
at least that's how it first like a viral video, that's where we become aware of it as opposed to it being released in the theater, because the good news is technology is making it easier not only for you to make good student films, but I mean, you know, it seems like we're going to get a lot of good guerrilla filmmaking.
Imagine if you had to carry film around.
Okay, this is the scene, and I was thinking of was Don Glut, and I go to Hank's friend's dorm room.
Tell people who Don mm-hmm. Glut is who don't remember.
Oh, Don Glut, great indie filmmaker, wrote a bunch of What If stories for Marvel, but is known as
I remember that interview.
Guerrilla
filmmaker.
On the show. Yeah. Had his career in both comics and in film.
Yeah.
Jumping out of moving cars.
Yeah. You know, 8mm films.
Right.
You know,
and, yeah, and his student films were all 16mm.
Yeah,
little,
you need to watch these films, Hank.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I go to Sal and Norton is sitting in for Hank's first student film, and we go to a friend's dorm room, and there are three Mac laptops and an HD
JVC HD
a couple boom mics and a couple lights, and I'm looking at the playback on this. I'm like, oh, he's got a fucking movie studio here in this fucking college dorm.
That's great.
And he's gonna have. You know, stereo sound, probably 5.1 sound, HD filming. It's a high-end HD video camera. Terrible talent, obviously.
Yeah,
you know, with us.
Look at that waste. Just waste.
But you can CGI you got that
the
shit
money.
In.
You know, and so
you got the money. I'm gonna blast your head off. I swear to God.
And what was awesome is that we're sitting there and we're sitting at it's a gambling scene. We're sitting at a poker table, and I'm sitting right by a tea stand that has mm-hmm. the light mm-hmm. That is lighting this whole scene. And one of the guys that you go to school with is like, you're like, okay, is the tea stand, you know, in the frame? And your buddy that is helping you edit this is like, that's fine. I can take that out in Photoshop and the scene will be fine.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, they're taking things that are in this scene and they're just going to wipe them out mm-hmm. and they're going to make this, you know, everything is basically green screened.
Black screened. Yeah, the windows in the dorm. The whole wall that is facing the city is floor-to-ceiling windows. So we wanted to black it out to make it look like a basement. So we took garbage bags and we covered the whole window. We, you know, we got like 30 garbage, like double-thick garbage bags.
Yeah.
So it acted, and we put black tape over the duct tape that we used to connect it. So It was a green screen.
And so, you know, I was going back and thinking about the conversations we had with Don, where he would take individual frames of film and adjust them and do color different them. Things with them, and his editing techniques, you know, basically darkroom techniques, and what you guys are able to do digitally now, it's amazing.
Chris has an afro in the movie.
Yeah, awesome that you've put in post production.
Yeah, I forgot to tell you, but
have you seen online? YouTube has had a lot of film, student films that are based on comic book scenes. And in fact, at wordballoon.com, I've set up a page, and I call it Comic Fan Film Festival, because it was just from seeing random tweets from Jason Aaron and Bendis saying, oh my God, a bunch of students did a Jessica Jones interrogation scene. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was really good. And there's a scene from the very first issue of Scalped that was shot, and Jason is like, hey, this is kind of cool. And yeah, it's a student film, but it was done pretty well. And, yeah. And you know, I'll be interested if you use any comic book scenes as inspiration.
Are you going to? Is that anything? You should.
Speaking of Alex Robinson.
Maybe I guess, Greg Rucka. Maybe something from
perhaps, Greg Rucka. A little Queen of Country.
I've never read it.
Motherfucker. What? Seriously?
It looks so boring.
Dude!
It's black and white.
Dude, I'm kidding. No, I just haven't gotten around to it. But I'm...
Seriously.
That's the thing.
No,
I've never read it.
Beyond the superhero stuff, obviously.
I've seriously never read it.
You can't read it now.
Yeah.
To satisfy
you. Stop the clock.
You're going to read it, and we'll 3 weeks later. We're going to stop the recording so that for the next 6 months he can catch up on Queen of
Kings. No, I was actually thinking about that recently because I finished Tricked like a few days ago.
Cool.
And I was like, oh, you know what? Something like this, you know, I not only would I be into, of course, yeah, I'd love to make like a huge comic book movie, yeah, but like I could do something like Tarot. Box Office Poison or Tarot.
You could do
Queen of Country. Tarot would be awesome.
No, something
like
Tarot.
You know it, everybody.
You could do Queen of Country.
I could
There's
do,
your full
I could
frontal
do Jinx.
Nudity you want to rent there, huh? Thomas. There you go.
I could do Jinx, was what I was looking
right.
For.
Right, exactly.
That'd be really funded.
Criminal. I'll give you more choices. It's Brubaker, criminal. And
how
stuff.
About Queen and Country Mouse? First volume.
Just make it just for Chris.
Perhaps.
Chris would want to get in on it. Chris is going to want to play a Terra Chase, though.
honestly,
so we got this wig.
You know, and I'm not. And forgive me, I'm not trying to just pimp my site because I do. I put a couple of them up there, but really, like, search around YouTube if you don't want to come.
No, that sounds like a really good idea. I mean,
really neat stuff over there.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people at school talking about it, but I haven't seen them yet. But
because you know, there's
I'd
also
love to do something.
Have
like
you,
that.
You know,
powers?
Well, that's why, and you know, I was thinking too about when I was setting up my new pages for the new site. Like, okay, I would like to get some of the good comic book fan films that have been made, mm-hmm. and it's like, you know,
the good ones.
Well, honestly, and there aren't that many, but there are a few. Like Sandy Collar's Batman Dead End. That's excellent. Where Batman, you know, fights the Joker, the Predator, and
that is good. That is
see,
good.
There
yeah.
you go.
Yeah, the one I can think of is that Lord of the Rings one that those
I haven't seen.
The,
Lord
the yeah. really big one yeah. that yeah. yeah,
I haven't seen that.
That was crazy.
I've seen half of it. Yeah.
There's a Green Arrow trailer that I had never seen that I was very impressed that, yeah. with, yeah. and I put that on the site. But yeah, you know, and it's funny, you know, Sandy Cholera, when they made Dead End, it was the year before, it was like 2004, and I started War Balloon in 2005, and I tried to get him on that first year, and he kind of blew me off. So I'm like, all right, whatever. And it's cool, you know, whatever.
Fuck him.
But yeah, I got to be honest. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. I don't think I need you on.
You know, well, you and fuck you.
You know, but I still love the movie.
Do you start to, you know, whenever you're reading comics now, Hank, and I know that you're a student, so, mm-hmm. so your time is limited. Do you start reading comics with an eye of how could this work cinematically?
Always have, yeah, yeah. Of course, yeah. Yeah. I mean, how could I not? I mean, every time I imagine it, it's how would I shoot this? I mean, like it, you know, they have the shots there, but you know. And I've adapted mm-hmm. some scenes just to see how it feels, but it's something I'm so interested
it's
in.
Terror is harder to make into a movie than you would think.
Yeah.
But, you know, we mentioned Criminal, but Incognito, I think, would
sure.
be...
Sure, Incognito.
Incognito would be great.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Or Queen and Country.
Or Queen and Country. Or
World of Warcraft.
Yeah. World of Warcraft, man. We're doing a fan film of World of Warcraft.
Watchmen.
How do you like Watchmen?
The book?
Yeah.
The
no, film. No, the movie. The movie.
We don't care what
What'd you think
about
of this year's
films?
This year's superhero films?
What was this year? Was Watchmen?
Wolverine Origins, Watchmen?
I haven't seen Wolverine Origins.
Okay.
I saw Watchmen in IMAX, which was a big mistake. It looked really bad in IMAX, but the movie was all right.
What else? Are we missing anything?
Whiteout.
Oh, that's right.
I didn't see Whiteout. Surrogates. Surrogates. Which I didn't get around to see.
And isn't that funny? Yeah, both. I got to be honest. I still haven't seen Whiteout.
They both kind of flopped, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Surrogates.
Yeah. Yes, they
really
did.
Flopped, yeah. Yeah. And so Whiteout was pushed back like a year, wasn't it?
Over two years.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's all right. And you know, I mean, as I told Greg, I'm like, you know, dude, when you really write the script as opposed to it being adapted from your material, then I will be excited. Just like when Johns was writing episodes of Smallville or Vaughn was writing episodes of Lost, it was time to get excited. But when they handed it to somebody else.
And they were good.
Well, and I think, and you might feel the same way, Hank, I think that the studios are starting to wise up to the fact that we really need the people that write these stories to be involved. And that's why it's great that Marvel has their creative
team. Yeah, the Marvel Studios, yeah.
Yeah, that literally does go out there. And you know, God, Bendis has been writing about and talking about being on set for Thor and how impressed he is. Fraction's been telling me about how he's been involved with Iron Man 2. I mean, that's the good news, is that they really are going to the experts and saying, help us, tell us what we're doing right, tell us, give us honest suggestions.
And so, Bendis was huge on Iron Man, the first one, right? Yeah.
And it's funny, because I didn't remember this, but Brian reminded me on a Bendis tapes about years ago when they were making that first Spider-Man movie, he and Stan got to do a similar sit-down with the producers, and they went to them and said, okay, do you have any input? And at that point, Stan is like, hey, guys, you take anything you want from my comics. You've got hundreds of issues to look at. I got to go. It was a pleasure meeting you. Take it easy. Whereas Bendis, being the film buff that he's like, oh, I want to stay. I want to do this. And it's like
– And Bill Jemis, right?
Yeah, I believe Jemis was there too. But they asked him, like, so what do you think? And he's like, well, you got to give him more wisecracks to make fun of Willem Dafoe's Goblin costume. Because, you know, it's kind of goofy looking. Mm-hmm, yeah. And their faces dropped and said, that costume cost $70,000. And he's like,
well, it's still goofy looking. And at that point, I knew I made a bunch of enemies in the room.
And it's true. And he's like, meanwhile, and he goes, it's true. Stan knew it was time to get up and leave. And he goes, and that's the difference between a veteran who's been in these meetings. But again, I think the tide is changing. But back then, no, I think it was still, you know. And I've heard that, too, about some of the other – The previous producers of Smallville holding some of our creator friends in a little bit of contempt and saying, yeah, that's really cute. Get those guys out of the room and let's get back to making our shitty comic book TV show.
Everyone, have a fantastic rest of your week. Of your
weekend. Is this the week of Christmas, technically?
I think it is. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, Hanukkah.
Whatever you worship.
I'm a druid. I'll be praying to a pile of rocks later on this week, so enjoy that.
She's druish.
Have a fantastic rest of your week and weekend. We'll be back again next week. I think Tom and I, we got to talk about whenever we're going to sit down and chit-chat about comics over the holiday break
here. We'll have to figure that out.
It'll be good.
Are you going to do a year-end show?
Nah, we do that on the 11 o'clock.
Right.
Okay, I'll tell you what. We'll get you.
What? Like, I don't have anything to say about the end of the year?
Please.
We'll talk.
I was going to see if you guys wanted to do a special year-end word balloon.
Mark says happy Festivus.
For the rest of us.
Our next recording.
Remember which one of these shows is popular. Remember which one of the shows you're on is popular.
Okay, what
positive
was
things. With normal people.
Semi-normal people.
You, me, John, and Hank will come over to my house. We'll watch Point Blank.
Oh, no, he's setting up another mandate.
I don't want to go on a mandate with you.
Too bad.
And we'll do our best of show. Okay. It'll be great.
All right.
Oh, watch my movie on YouTube. It'll be up by...
When?
What's the name of it? Oh, it'll be up by the time this comes out.
What's the name of it?
8th Street?
8th Street.
Yeah. All right, I expect a URL, direct people at roundcomics.com and wordballoon.com to your...
8th Street.
Yeah.
Or we'll embed the movie
itself. I'm in it. I look shocked at some point.
And he's drinking.
Gee, there's something. Yeah, big funny.
Actual
news.
Liquor.
What are the odds?
No, it was apple juice.
My favorite was what he a couple weeks acting. Ago. A couple weeks ago, and I forget what drink it was, and he goes, "That's a good morning drink to have." And I'm like, "Jesus Christ, man, put the fucking bottle down."
All right, let's finish this.
Oh my god. Temperance meeting coming. Fuck the man.
Exactly. We'll be back again it's next intervention. Monday with another full length episode. In the meantime,
in the meantime,
thank you. We'll be everywhere
in our own comics. Mandates. I don't want to go on that day.
Tom, you're going to go on it. You're going to watch Payback. You're going to watch Point Blank. And then
I don't want to go on a man day.
Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2009.